United States v. Angeles, number 16-1354. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. John Arcisi, Assistant Federal Public Defender, appearing on behalf of the appellant Armando Angeles. Your Honors, the district court here held that the traffic stop of Mr. Angeles' vehicle was justified on two grounds. It was wrong as to both, and I will address each in turn. With respect to the first ground, the Wichita wiretap, the court's factual findings about the universe of facts that supported the probable cause determination here was clearly erroneous. And we know that because the government's witnesses, Detective Lynch and Trooper Hill, did not, and indeed could not, establish what some other unknown, unidentified, non-testifying officers based a probable cause conclusion upon. All they could testify to was having been relayed that conclusion.
Could I just ask, you mentioned probable cause. Could the Wichita wiretap investigation, in combination with the collective knowledge doctrine, provide a justification for the stop if, I know you may not agree with this, but if that evidence established reasonable suspicion as opposed to probable cause? I'm just interested in the threshold requirement for the stop based on this justification.
Sure. And I don't dispute that under Arvizo or our other case, the reasonable suspicion could justify the stop, but we're not, I don't think in this case that we're not looking at a quantum, a varying quantum of proof. We're looking at the zero-sum game at the end of the day. The evidence didn't establish any universe of facts that were collectively known to law enforcement.
I'm not following that argument. Maybe you need to make it a little bit clearer. I don't follow how you're answering Judge Matheson's question.
So reasonable, probable cause gets them.
No, it's not probable cause. He's asking, is this reasonable suspicion?
If it, either probable cause or reasonable suspicion could flow from the wiretap and would justify the stop. Probable cause would extend that justification to also searching the vehicle. Here, the district court only made findings with respect to probable cause. Although the government did argue reasonable suspicion or probable cause below, the court only reached the probable cause question. The issue here doesn't turn on a quantum of proof, probable cause versus reasonable suspicion, however, because the court's findings are clearly erroneous as to the entire universe of facts. So we're not dealing with is it reasonable suspicion or probable cause. It's either there's nothing to support the court's findings that there was a universe of facts that were collectively known to law enforcement that would establish either reasonable suspicion or probable cause. Essentially, the government's evidence.
Well, the universe of facts that you're referring to in a motion to suppress is based entirely upon the facts. Now, I've been reading these, and I'm not quite sure I'm with you on the universal facts, because it appears to me that there was a basis for the trial court to find that there was reasonable suspicion to stop this vehicle. Now, what am I missing?
Based on the wiretap or based on the traffic violation?
Either way.
Traffic violation.
This is a classic example, having been a district court, where you got double-barreled. In other words, you got hit with both the one and then went on and say, but under Kansas law, there was reasonable suspicion of passing over this double line or whatever it was for them at least to make the stop. Now, so, like I say, you got double barreled, but nonetheless, there are facts that I see that would support the trial court in saying, based upon the evidence of what the officer saw you crossing, there was a basis for that stop. Am I missing it?
So let me take each in turn, and I'll take Your Honor's question first. With respect to the traffic, purported traffic violation. We don't dispute the factual finding with respect to that issue. That is that the tires twice crossed the fog line. The issue is a legal determination that that is patently insufficient under the Kansas Supreme Court's jurisprudence as articulated in Marx as to what constitutes a traffic violation of Section 81522. That is, that it must be more than an, quote, incidental or minimal breach of the fog lines. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that the weather conditions somehow mitigate that isn't actually really salient because it's a separate inquiry. There's this threshold inquiry that the Marx Court articulated in 2009 that says that these small, momentary, incidental violations of occasionally veering over the line doesn't necessarily constitute a violation of the statute, and so it is not reasonable for the trooper to base suspicion on the facts of this case with respect to the traffic
stop. The difference there is that in Marx there was just one crossing, and here we've got crossing the line twice, and all the officer needs is reasonable suspicion. Why isn't that enough?
Because Marx, for two reasons, Your Honor. First is because Marx says that minor and incidental breaches that such as occurred here are not enough. And second, Marx actually involved a vehicle that swerved across the fog line, then overcorrected and swerved across the center line. And so there actually were two violations in Marx. I think the trooper was playing this numbers game on some level that Marx, elsewhere in Marx, the court says, they need to allege more than a single incident.
Counsel, let me ask you this. On the basis of your argument and what I'm hearing, you approach a stop sign that says stop, does not say ooze. But under your argument, if the driver of the vehicle comes up but doesn't stop and oozes on through, that's therefore not a basis for the officer to stop because you did not stop at a stop sign?
Having been pulled over for a rolling stop before, I'd suggest that's probably not the case. But I don't know
the stats. It exactly fits the argument you're making.
No, it's not, Your Honor, for one key reason, which is that I don't know that the statute in that case is the same. Here, the statute has what's called this practicability standard, and that's what the Kansas Supreme Court's decision really turned on, that there's this language in that statute that requires compliance as near as practicable as is possible, and that it went on to suggest that practicability standard is even further diluted, that it doesn't require exact compliance, and that's why momentary breaches aren't enough.
Now, I've got one more question for you, and I hope after that I'll leave you alone. But what you've been telling me now raises my suspicion more and more about the government saying that you did not raise these arguments below, quoting your objection being specifically challenged that the initial stop was unjustified, and having read the briefs and looked at the court's argument, did you make this exact arguments that you're making now to us at the district court level?
So,
based upon that broad statement,
I don't. The answer is no. That specific statute and that specific argument was not articulated in the exact way that is being made here. But I don't think that impacts preservation here because the underlying principles, right, of preservation are that the government and the court be on alert as to what the issues are. And Mr. Angeles's brief notified the government of its burden to establish a constitutionally permissible basis for the stop in this case. The district court clearly understood the issues that were before it, didn't even invite argument, really, at the end of the hearing, and then ruled on the issues, agreeing with the government's proffered reasons. It's those reasons that we proffer, that we challenge now on appeal. It's not like if I was challenging the constitutionality, the Kansas statute as being constitutionally overbroad or something, or challenging the territoriality of the Warren application or something, that'd be a very different case. Those aren't things that were ever reached or discussed below. What we're challenging on appeal are precisely the issues that the district court ruled on the merits. And I think ultimately, with respect to the traffic stop, it doesn't make one difference whether or not I'm on de novo review or plain error review, because plain error, I think it's plain, the error here is plain under Marx, that it would not be reasonable for an officer to have suspicion under these circumstances. And with respect to Mr. Angeles' first challenge, with respect to the wiretap.
Well, before you get there, let me just make sure I understand. You agree do you not, that the district court did rely on the traffic violation as one ground to justify the stop? I mean, this isn't something that the government's raising on appeal and you're responding to it now.
No, it's not an alternative basis.
So the district court relied on that ground, and that and if you want to challenge that ground, you need to make that objection, make that argument. I mean, that's what the preservation requirements would be.
And I don't, I'm not suggesting that the efforts below were a paragon of best practices in preservation, but I think were they adequate to put the court on notice that, A, Mr. Angeles challenged the facts of whether or not his tires actually went over. The court made findings. We don't dispute those now. And, B, whether that was a violation of the statute. Yeah, I think that is clear from the record, and I think particularly from defense counsel's questioning during the hearing. And I think that the court understood that because the court ruled on both those issues, saying, yes, this is the tires went over the line. I find the officers credible, and that that is a violation of the statute. But again, I think under plain error review, even we necessarily have to win because the error here under Marks is just, I think it's plain that the conduct here is not even as egregious as occurred in Marks, and that thus the officers wouldn't find reasonable suspicion. Now, with respect to the wiretap, this is a clear error challenge to the factual findings. Those findings necessarily only exist after they have been made. And so to suggest that challenge is somehow waived, I think, is just patently erroneous. There's nothing to suggest in anything the government cites that I'm aware of that a party has to file a motion for reconsideration challenging the district court's findings in an order that it puts out. So I think that clear error challenge is very plainly before the court. And with respect to that, I want to make one point, which is that all we have from Detective Lynch and Trooper Hill is relaying the conclusions of some other officers that probable cause existed, or that a stop was, or that a pending drug deal was plausibly likely to occur. That's very different than cases like Whitley and Chavez that are discussed in the briefing, where we know what the officer who was directing the stop knew because that person testified. They testified as to what constituted the basis for their reasonable suspicion or probable cause. We don't have that here, and it's fatal to the government's position. I'd reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank
Good morning, Your Honors. James Brown for the United States. Your Honors, I'd like to start out by speaking about the preservation and waiver issues. It's our contention that the defendant has not preserved either claim he is making now on appeal. Of course, this Court has stated in the White case, which we cite in our Rule 28J letter, and I'm quoting because it's so important to our argument, quote, to avoid waiving a particular argument, the party must make sufficiently definite, specific, detailed, and non-conjectural factual allegations supporting his suppression claim in his pretrial motion. That's what this court said. And then in Rodabaugh, which is a 2015 case, the court went on to say, it's not enough for a party to make a remark to the district court that is related to the eventual point on appeal. Thus, we have held that an appeal point is not preserved by vague, all-encompassing statements that fail to alert the district court to the issue eventually raised on appeal. Here, the defendant attempted to preserve both these issues by stating, this is it, defendant, quote, specifically challenges that the initial stop was justified. Now, he does make a sufficiently specific, detailed, specific, and non-conjectural factual allegation supporting suppression, but he does so for the first time on appeal through claims 1 and 2. This is the first time he's making these very fact-specific claims, and in large part, at least as to issue 1, he's supporting that claim by citing gaps in the record, gaps in the factual record, relating to the existence of probable cause that we could have cleared up and the district court could have cleared up if the defendant had alerted us to the fact that he was raising this very issue that he raises now in appeal. But instead, he didn't raise the issue. We didn't know that he was going to argue these things. The district court didn't know that. And now he cites the gaps in the factual record as support for his argument. That's just not how you preserve an argument or a claim in this court. Therefore, it is waived. And we'd specifically, if we may, point the court to the Barajas-Chavez case, which we cite in our 28J letter, where all the defendant did in that case was say the roadblock was illegal, but he didn't say why it was illegal. And this court said that was not enough because the defendant's written filings before the district court, quote, made only perfunctory references to the stop and search with no mention of any facts showing the roadblock was illegal.
Could I just, as a matter of clarification, you say waived, but within that statement, are you saying that the issue was forfeited and there's been no plain error argument and therefore it's waived?
No, what we're saying is number one, it is waived because in White, this court says that that's a waiver if you don't make sufficiently definite, specific, detailed, and non-conjectural factual allegations. That's a waiver, not a forfeiture. Number two, it's also a waiver based on the Schrader and Franco cases that we cite for the proposition that under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 12b3 and 12c3, that is a waiver and it is not subject to plain error review because it's not forfeited. It's a waiver. It's not a forfeiture. And therefore, it's not subject to plain error review. We're saying that if it is a forfeiture and not a waiver, then and only then you get the plain error review. But we think that you don't get the plain error review under the Schrader and Franco cases, which are unpublished cases from this court.
Because?
Well, what this court says in Franco is that in matters of pretrial suppression, Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 12c3 instructs us to disregard any arguments not presented below. So that's what this court said in Franco. 12c3 states that if a party does not meet the deadline for making a Rule 12b3 motion, the motion is untimely.
But this is going to your waiver, and I thought you had taken the next step and said, but if we are on plain error, they haven't argued plain error.
Plain error is a fallback.
That's where I thought you could go.
All right, and at this point, we can't argue that they waived plain error. We can't say they waived plain error. They waived their arguments. They haven't waived the ability to argue plain error because they did argue plain error in their reply brief.
And our precedent allows for arguing plain error in the reply brief even if it hasn't been argued in the opening brief?
That is correct. So then if it's not waived, and this court says it's not waived, then this court can consider the arguments under the plain error standard if they're not waived. But we maintain that they're waived and that there's really little question about that based upon the cases that we've already talked about. That being said, I'd like to move to issue two, if I could, which is the stop for violation of the Kansas statute. Now, what the defendant has stated is that even under plain error review, he wins, and he cites in support of his argument State of Kansas versus Marks, where the Kansas Supreme Court talked about this statute. Now, we think that Marks does not stand for what the defendant says, and that the court's finding that this stop was valid was not plainly erroneous based on Marks. Marks says, and this is Marks's holding, a detaining officer must articulate something more than an observation of one instance of a momentary lane breach. Here we had, as Judge Matheson pointed out, two instances of lane breaches. So this falls squarely outside of Marx's holdings. Now the defendant points out, well, in Marx, you actually had two lane breaches, so this is no worse than Marx. But if you look at the Marx case on page 675, the case was decided on the factual proposition that there was only one lane breach. On page 675, the court says, the deputy only observed one instance where the motorhome did not maintain a single lane. That's on page 675. So the court decided Marks on the basis of that single breach proposition. Now, we also maintain that Marks is distinguishable from this case, and here's why. In Marks, as the court stated on pages 675 and 676, there was no information about the traffic or road conditions. There was no testimony if it was practicable for the driver to maintain a single lane, and there was no information about how far the vehicle crossed over the line. Here we have all three information points on those items. The court found that the sun was bright and there was no significant wind, so that's one thing about the traffic conditions. Number two, the court made a factual finding, which the defendant does not contest, that there was no independent condition which would render it impracticable for the defendant to maintain a single lane. That's the second thing. And the third thing is that we do have information about how far the vehicle crossed the line because Trooper Hill testified that the passenger's tires crossed the fog line twice by a tire width or so. That's Volume 3, pages 50, and Volume 3, page 56. So, in Marks, it was decided on the factual proposition of one-lane breach with no other information about the conditions surrounding that breach. Here we have two-lane breaches, and we have testimony and factual findings, which defendant does not contest, about the factual findings surrounding that breach. Marks is distinguishable. Therefore, Marks cannot serve as a basis for finding that the district court plainly erred. Having said that, this court can rely on its other cases interpreting 8.15.22, which are not contrary to Marks. In fact, they're consistent with Marks. We've cited four cases. We cited the Osborne case, two-lane breaches within a quarter mile under optimal conditions. We cited the Klein case, one-lane breach with brisk wind that could not have caused the breach. We cited Zabalza, two breaches with some wind, and Barraza-Martinez, which is a post-Marks case, where this court talks about Marks, where there were two breaches in rainy weather, and the defendant drove on or over the fog line for 1/8 of a mile. So we give you four cases that are consistent with Marks, and Marks is distinguishable. Therefore, this stop is good under 8.15.22. That means we're basically done. But I'm going to talk, if I may, move on to issue number one. And that is whether or not there was reasonable suspicion or probable cause to stop defendant's vehicle based upon the calls and texts that preceded the stop. Here, defendant's main argument is that there are no factual findings about the probable cause. We don't know who knew what when. Fine. Tell us that is going to be your argument before we put on our evidence so we can confront that, so the judge can know about that. He says there are gaps in the factual record about these very points. We can't possibly know. Well, that's because you didn't bring it up and tell us what you were contesting. Even so, we think we still win because the testimony from Officer Lynch was crystal clear. And he said that all the phone calls that were made, all the calls and texts that were made by these two individuals, defendant and Sanchez, were made in real time and that the officers became aware of them in real time. That's Volume 3, page 42. And on the basis of that testimony, that the Wichita officers knew about all the calls and texts in real time as they were coming through and processed that information in real time, basically defeats the defendant's entire argument. He simply just ignores that testimony because he says it's not specific enough. But we have four pages of testimony about why Officer Long thought that, and the whole procedure for these coming in. And again, that's Volume 3, page 42. Lynch said, yes, all of these phone calls a person is made aware of in the Wichita area, either by phone call or they view them come in real time. And then we have the collective knowledge doctrine. Detective Lynch testified that the units were briefed over the course of 3 days and told there may be a pending drug deal coming, and we would need to do surveillance. And then they did that surveillance. They were up on Sanchez, who went to this house where he presumably got drugs. They were at the Townies Shopping Center Mall conducting their surveillance where they saw the transaction. They were right on defendant's car when he left that transaction. there's just no reason to think that there's not enough reasonable suspicion to stop that car or probable cause. Now, Judge Matheson asked my colleague whether or not this reasonable suspicion could have justified the stop. Just to be clear, and I would repeat what my colleague said, reasonable suspicion will justify the stop, but you need probable cause to search the car. Here, the government argued below that we had both reasonable suspicion and probable cause to stop that car. That's volume 1, page 30. And the district court found that we had probable cause based upon the numerous calls and texts and conversations introduced at the suppression hearing. So there's no question that we had enough information to stop this car. The defendant's whole argument, his whole argument, is that we didn't sufficiently establish that we received all of the calls and texts that we talked about in the factual basis in our brief before we stopped the car. But Detective Lynch's testimony was exactly that we did have all the calls and texts in real time. We briefed our officers about it the 3 days before the stop. Based on that information received from the calls and texts, we performed surveillance and we communicated to the trooper who actually made the stop that we had probable cause to stop that car based on an impending drug deal. So we think we have probable cause. We think we win under issue one for that reason. So just to summarize a little bit, number one, defendant has waived these claims. They are waived, not merely forfeited. They're waived because he didn't sufficiently brief them before the district court. He gave us no idea what the legal ground for his challenge to the initial stop was. He identified his basis for challenging the stop for the first time on appeal. Number two, they're waived under Rule 12b-3 and 12c-3 based upon the Schrader and Franco cases. Number three, they both fail under plain error review. Issue one fails under plain error review at step one because we did have sufficient probable cause to stop the car. And issue number two, the stop of the car under 8-15-22, fails under plain error review because Marks did not provide any basis for the district court to find that this stop was invalid because Marks was distinguishable. And for all of those reasons, we're asking that this court affirm the district court's decision today.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I've got just three brief points in rebuttal. First, it was the government's burden to establish constitutionally permissible bases for the stops. They chose to put on witnesses that could not establish the evidence that they needed to. That's not Mr. Angeles' fault. That is a failing of the government. This idea that Detective Lynch's testimony somehow got them over the finish line is erroneous because his testimony about how the system works generally is not evidence that that's how it worked in this case, nor is it evidence that that information, even if it was relayed in real time from St. Louis to Wichita, that it was then communicated amongst officers. All we have are general conclusions that were communicated to Detective Lynch and Trooper Hill.
Counsel, let me ask one real quick question. Is the record going to show us, as I understand what the district court was saying, aside from your arguments on the stop, did your client consent to the search?
Yes, there was consent to the search, and that's not disputed on appeal. Obviously, that consent is invalidated if the initial stop is invalid. My second point is that there is an intra-circuit split between Schrader and Franco on the one hand, Elliott and Garcia Escalera on the other, all unpublished cases, about the scope of the 2014 amendments to Rule 12. That's what the government's suggesting with respect to waiver. This court has indicated, again, in the Elliott and Garcia cases I cited, that the Rule 12 waivers may be the amendments may be inconsistent with this court's prior precedent on that point. And that's why we believe plain error is warranted. I would direct the court to the Sixth Circuit's decision in the Soto case that I cited. I think it has a good discussion of the history of the amendments and why they now permit plain error review. And third, I just want to reiterate that Mr.
Can I just make sure I understand that last point? So your understanding of the amendments would point to forfeiture, plain error, rather than waiver.
Yes. That now plain error review is available for claims not raised during a suppression hearing. And then third, just briefly, Mr. Angelis' first claim is, again, it's a clear error claim. The first option he had was on appeal to raise that. The second is that even under a plain error review, Zander footnote 5 is the response to the preservation in the reply, in a reply brief. And I see the amount of time, so I would simply ask that you reverse the district court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This case will be submitted. We thank counsel for your arguments, and counsel are excused.